This conference is now being recorded.
Good evening, everybody, and welcome to the Mental Health Professionals Network first GP Focus webinar on collaborative care for people with chronic pain and mental health issues. We've had 150 GPs from around Australia register to participate, and so far we have about 36 people online. So welcome to everybody. My name's Mary Emelaeus, and I'll be facilitating tonight's session. I'm a GP, and I am also a psychotherapist. I work at Headspace in Cairns, and I previously worked at Headspace in Townsville. Been involved with Mental Health Professionals Network for a few years, and I have facilitated a couple of webinars and been a participant on the panel in a few. It's something I really enjoy, having the multidisciplinary discussion, and I think most of the participants find it really useful. So what I'd like to do, first of all, is to introduce our panellists tonight. So first of all, I'd like to introduce Dr. Stephen Lowe, who's our GP. He's a practitioner based in Adelaide in South Australia. He has specific interests in diabetes and pain management. He's clinical director of GP Plus in Elizabeth in suburban South Australia and a chair of the RACGP Special Interest Group of Pain Management. Stephen is chair of the primary care group of the National Pain Summit, a member of the International Association for the Study of Pain, Neuropathic Pain and Education Special Interest Group, and a member of the Australian Pain Society. So Stephen, I think you're probably one of the best qualified GPs in Australia to be contributing as a GP tonight. How did you first develop your interest in pain?
Well, I actually got an attachment under an old scheme to one of the hospital pain units in Adelaide. And then from there, it got me curious and more curious, and I entered a study period looking at pain, and I ended up here.
Okay, well, thank you. Welcome to the panel. And then Nick Economus is a physiotherapist on our panel. So Nick completed his Bachelor of Applied Science in Physiotherapy in 1992 at Sydney University. He was the Senior Physiotherapist and Coordinator of the Pain Management Programs at Cedar Court Rehabilitation Hospital for 5 years before establishing a new pain management service at the Valley Private Hospital, focusing on compensable clients. Nick currently works in private practice at Empower Rehab, an interdisciplinary clinic of physiotherapists and psychologists who focus on the best practice management of complex and chronic pain conditions in the community. He also runs workshops for allied health professionals involved in the rehabilitation of clients with persistent pain conditions. Now, Nick, I know where Sydney University is, but I don't know where Cedar Court Rehabilitation Hospital is or the Valley Private Hospital. So which state are you based in?
In Victoria, so both of those were in the eastern suburbs of Melbourne, I'm in Heidelberg now, which is in the northern suburbs of Melbourne.
And I can see that you've also got a lot of experience in working in an interdisciplinary way with chronic pain patients, so it's great to have you on the panel.
Thanks, Mary.
Jackie Stanford, welcome Jackie, is a psychologist on our panel tonight. She's currently a director and principal psychologist of Empower Rehab, who specialise in providing interdisciplinary pain management, as well as working with clients presenting with a range of psychological presentations. Jackie provides training and supervision to health professionals and return to work professionals about the management of clients with persistent pain to help facilitate recovery and optimal function. She also lectures postgraduate psychology students in pain management. Jackie's a member of the Australian Psychological Society and the Health College, the International Association for the Study of Pain, and the Australian Pain Society. Jackie was the Australian Psychological Society representative of the Australian National Pain Summit. Now, Nick also works at Empower Rehab. So does that mean that you work in the same practice?
Yes.
And how long have you been working in that practice at the same time?
We set up the practice probably about 4 years ago. It sort of started evolving because we previously worked together at Cedar Court Rehabilitation Hospital, and then set it up in the community to try and reduce the wait times that it takes for people to be able to get interdisciplinary treatment.
Okay, and is it a busy clinic?
it's getting busier and busier. It's very busy. Okay. Yeah, a number of psychologists and physios working there.
Fantastic. Thank you very much. And last but not least, I'd like to introduce Dr. Toby Sachs, who's the psychiatrist on the panel tonight. And Toby specialises in the psychiatric management of patients with chronic pain, including those with opioid and other addictive behaviours. Now, Toby, I've noticed from the questions that the GPs have submitted that they would like answered that this particular issue about medication in chronic pain is something that is really on the minds of GPs.
Yes, it's very much so, problem, because it's difficult for most GPs to assess whether the pain patient is needing as much pain medication as they usually want.
Yes.
The difficulty of trying to assess whether there's a dependent issue or not.
Well, it's great to have you on the panel.
Thank you
very much. Now, I just want to remind everybody about our learning objectives. So this webinar will help improve your understanding of the relationship between chronic pain and mental health, improve your referral pathways by identifying the role of different disciplines in contributing to the assessment, treatment and management of people with chronic pain and mental health issues, and explore GP-specific tips and strategies for interdisciplinary collaboration in supporting people with chronic pain and mental health issues. So the way that we're going to base our discussion tonight around a case study, and you've all read that in advance, so we're going to talk about Bron, who is a 54-year-old woman who has experienced chronic pain and mental health symptoms. And this is a very important topic for primary care clinicians for lots of reasons. I guess people like Bron are some of the most complex patients that we manage as GPs, and I guess often some of the ones where we feel a lack of support. Often there are really good interdisciplinary pain clinics through the public system, but the waiting list might be months to years long. And as Jackie said, that's one of the reasons they opened their clinic. Not everybody has an Empower rehab down the road. And so it's fantastic to be able to have this discussion tonight. Now, I will, the way that things work is that each of the panellists is going to give a short discipline-specific response to the case, followed by questions and answers between the panel and then between the panel and the audience. So I have received copies of the questions that the participants have submitted, and I'll also try to keep an eye on the chat box. So hopefully we'll get to cover as much as we can of the things that people are feeling is important. So currently we have 45 participants online and the five of us, so it's a conversation between 50 people, which is excellent. Before we start our discipline-specific responses, we're just going to have a quick word from Stephen about why he thinks that this issue is particularly important for GPs. Thanks, Stephen.
Thanks, Marie. Now, what we were taught in university was that pain was the result of a disease or injury, and that pain is proportional to the damage, so if you've got more damage, you've got more pain. If you've got less damage, you've got less pain. That if we simply cure the disease or fix the injury, pain will go away. If pain doesn't go away, it must be in the patient's head. And there's something called neuropathic pain, which comes from nerve damage. And that was about the extent of it, because probably like me, a majority of practitioners had never had any specific training in pain. On the other hand, what the International Association for Study of Pain describes pain as is an unpleasant sensory and emotional experience. And I want to focus on the word experience associated with actual or potential tissue damage. So it is not only real tissue damage, but it's potential tissue damage, and described in such terms of such damage. Looking at pain as an experience constant link between an injury and the experience of pain, I think is one of the key messages to bring across tonight. It is not a straight continuum. When we deal with acute pain, it looks a bit more like that, but when the pain becomes chronic, there are many factors that impact on the experience of pain, and it's psychological factors. It's not that pain is there and there's some psychological factors involved in it, is that the psychological factors are key in the progression of the pain. And I think it's really important because as GPs, we are the key people in the transition point between acute pain and chronic pain. And knowing how it progresses and being in control of that is really important. So what I would like you to consider tonight is that pain does not equal injury and vice versa. That pain is not a simple sensation, but it's a complex experience. And there are many things that affect the experience of pain. That we can do much to influence these outcomes by simply being aware of all of the factors impacting on pain, and that chronic pain is very, very much in our ball court. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Stephen. So I would like now to move into the... I should just say, for those participants who haven't been in one of these webinars before, you will have access to the slides later on, because I think that some of the things that Stephen's presented already have been really useful. So you'll find that there are other things you want to be able to revisit, and you can see those through the slides available online later on the MHPN website, and also you can actually watch the webinar via podcast at a later date. So, Stephen,
yes.
I'm going to actually got a bit confused here.
That's okay. I just got one more slide, and this is a summary of what we tried to do, that the psychological factors have a major impact on our perception of pain, that what we say, do, and act in the course of a consult has an impact of pain, and we are often unaware of how chronic pain unfolds, or how pain unfolds, and therefore we are more passive in our approach, and that if we do small things, that can actually have major effects on outcomes.
That's really helpful. Yes, I've experienced that myself, and I'm really glad that you've introduced that side of it, because I think we do sometimes feel overwhelmed or suspicious that it's going to become overwhelming early on, and I think passivity is a natural response. So first of all, with our discipline-specific response, I'd like to invite Nick, who's our physiotherapist, to talk about his response to meeting Bron through the case study. Thanks, Nick.
Thanks, Mary. Look, I find sort of Bron's case a fascinating one because I guess with hindsight it's much easier to see where things could have been a little bit different. But as we know, these cases do unfold and do progress in ways that we don't often expect. But from an assessment perspective, one of the key findings for me is that the current treatment approach that the physiotherapist is providing is a very passive approach. It's around sort of massage and techniques that are really being done to the patient, to Bron. And really we know that the evidence base is more for an active approach when we're looking at the management of chronic pain. We know from the scans and from the examination findings, there weren't any concerning features when it comes to what might be happening pathologically. We also know from the Erebro score, which is a questionnaire that really looks at those psychosocial factors that may impact on the development of chronic pain, that Bron has scored a very high score of 171. Considering 130 out of 210 is a high risk score, she certainly scored very high, and that really should alert us very early on that there's a very good chance that Bron will develop chronic pain disability and most likely be off work if we look into the future. And the current physio treatment may just be providing more of a supportive or counselling role that Bron likes seeing the physiotherapist, and seeing the physiotherapist often enough is probably a bit of a dependency issue that's developing pretty early on. So from my perspective, an early referral for psychology would be a really important part of managing Bron, not waiting until it's too late, until it's really obvious, using things like the risk screening tool like the Erebro to help us in really identifying those who are at high risk and doing something about it. As Mary said before, being passive and waiting for the train wreck to happen is probably not the best option. So when we look at management, what I'd be looking at from a physiotherapist perspective, the primary thing would be Education is vital, and that could happen within the acute setting, it could happen within the subacute or the chronic setting, but education around the what the meaning of the pain is, and really trying to reduce that fear that that any extra pain relates to further tissue damage or harm, as Stephen mentioned before, and to really provide some permission for Bryan to actually start to move, and to move in the knowledge that she won't harm herself, she won't damage herself if she performs normal activities in a graded way. It would be really important to really shift the approach from this passive treatment approach that's being provided at the moment to a much more active approach where the physiotherapist is taking much more of a coaching role rather than the doing role, so to speak. And to start with that process, it's really important to set some very clear goals. And we all know what SMART goals are, but to really actually spend the time to work with Bryan, to work out what are the important things that she's wanting to focus on as part of her treatment, and then using treatment to achieve those goals by assisting Bryan to gradually re-engage in those meaningful activities. We know one of the key things there is that that Bryan has been pulling out of cooking a famous or infamous roast and dancing and performing other leisure activities, working as well. And these are really meaningful activities that we know that if people don't engage in these activities, they're more likely to have increasing mood issues, which are more likely to impact on their pain, and the spiral, the downward spiral continues. So working out a plan of how we can gradually re-engage in those activities would be really important, and problem solving around that. Now, we might facilitate that by an exercise program that looks at trying to simulate some of those activities. So it might be simulating the task of cooking, which might involve some lifting, some bending, some reaching with some exercises, and directly relating them to the activities that Bryan has identified as part of her functional goals, so whether it be the cooking or the walking or dancing or work. Utilising the benefits of return to work. We know there's a lot of research coming through now that people who are off work for long periods of time have worse physical and psychological outcomes, and re-engaging them back in meaningful work improves those physical and psychological outcomes. So looking at how we can problem solve around assisting Bryan in getting back into work, and how we can communicate with others, whether that be other treaters, like the treating GP or the psychologist, or perhaps the employer or the insurer, to look at developing a plan that doesn't wait until Bryan makes 100% recovery. And lastly, looking at developing self-management strategies. So Bryan is confident that she can actually control her pain, that if she does have an increase in her symptoms, she has a flare-up in her pain, she has a range of skills that she can implement when she wants to, how she wants to get through that flare up and get back on track again, rather than simply relying on a treat to provide some ongoing passive treatment. Thanks, Mary.
Thank you, Stephen. I did want to just ask you one thing. You did say that we all know what SMART goals are, but I'm not totally sure. I was wondering if you would. If you would mind just giving us a quick refresher on SMART goals, or I can do that if you...
Well, we know SMART goals are around the goal being very specific, measurable, achievable, relevant, and time. So as an example, I guess for Bryan, it might be around a cooking goal, might be around to be able to return to cooking the Sunday roast with the assistance of one of her children, once a week or once a fortnight within the next 4 weeks. So it's very clear that this is what we're aiming to achieve. It's something that's really important to her is cooking the roast. There's a time frame around the next 4 weeks. It's realistic because she'll be getting some help from someone else to achieve that goal. And we're very clear as to what that goal is. It's very specific as well. And then you can really look at measuring how you're travelling, how the intervention is working to achieve that goal. And once that's achieved, we know achieving those goals in itself improves people's mood and therefore improves people's pain as well. So setting and achieving goals is a really important treatment modality within itself.
Thank you for that. And I know that there is a really good evidence base around that comes out of motivational interviewing, and I think it's something that it seems so simple that we forget to do it sometimes. but it actually has, there's a lot of evidence at work. So thank you for that. And so now I'd like to invite Jackie to give us the response of a psychologist to meeting Bron.
Thank you. One of the first things I think that it raises for me is what is the role of a psychologist in pain, because so often we get involved and we get referrals once as an adjustment disorder, once as a significant presentation of depression or anxiety. But really the role of psychology is to look at where the psychosocial factors are going on. So with someone like Bron, possibly from the start, well, always from the start, none of us like pain. There's always going to be some worry, some concern. The fact she's presented to the doctor is saying, hang on, what's going on here? So as a psychologist from the start, I think it's important that psychosocial factors are looked at, because as has already been said, it's these that can help the snowball start into the chronic pain picture. So looking at conflict in a workplace or the fears or worry, any stress that Bron is feeling about the pain or about work, her coping abilities. And it's really interesting, the research really shows that if it's early intervention, it's often a really small number of sessions that is needed that's targeted at addressing these barriers can actually prevent the development of that complexity. Now, of course, someone like Bron, and in the case study, got the referral once it had deteriorated a fair way. So we often then, of course, get involved where there may be some sort of mental illness or diagnosis of some sort. And this can either be a pre-existing crisis, an injury, a depression or anxiety, because that's still going to have an impact on the pain presentation. It still will be an indicator of their coping resources and their best options for treatment, but also can often occur secondary to an injury as an adjustment disorder. So with someone like Bron, I think there's a couple of really key things that it's important that as GPs you're looking for, that your psychologist would be looking at with someone like Bron. One is what, as a psychologist, we'd call our sort of standard psychosocial assessment, but we would look at things like mood, sleep, family, in sort of significant background things. But more importantly, with someone like Bron, you really want someone who has an understanding of pain and of function and can assess that in some detail. So things like gaining an understanding of what was going on at the time of injury, both in the workplace and at home, that may have actually precipitated the presentation. It doesn't necessarily mean that these are then the causal factors or change the way you treat it, but just having an understanding of what else might be perpetuating, what else might be going on in Bron's case. Gaining understanding about the Bron's beliefs about pain, that's twofold. It's both a medical understanding of what they think, and as a GP, you're going to be in a lot better place to understand a lot of the terms that as a psychologist, we don't really know what they mean. But really, it's getting understanding of what they believe. Do they believe they've got any control over their pain, or do they believe they're pain controls them? Do they believe they can do things still, or are they disabled? Are they seeking a cure, or do they believe they can manage life with it? And do they believe that the pain is a sign of further damage? And things like, are they catastrophizing about their pain, and what's their self-efficacy? Do they believe they've got any influence there? Assessment ideally also really looks at that impact on function. And as Nick's already commented on, Bron's function has been significantly impacted in each area of her life. And each of those areas needs to be considered. It's not about just looking at work or avoiding looking at work or just home. It's the whole picture of Bron's life needs to be considered. And acceptance is one of the big challenges in chronic pain, acceptance of pain and what that actually means. As a psychologist, that's something I'd always be assessing with Bron. And from the case study, I'd say it was very poor acceptance. She's still coming back, wanting a cure, wanting her pain to be gone, and that's a bit of a flag of something that can become an ongoing problem. As Nick said, functional goals are really important and not simply focusing on symptom reduction. And one is to set the direction, but to me it's also functional goals give a client hope. They're saying, hang on a minute, we're planning on moving forward. It's not about accepting this is the status quo, you've got this level of pain, put up with it. It's saying, hang on, you've got pain, it's horrible, it's distressing, it's unpleasant, but we're going to work forward at actually engaging you in these activities. So it gives hope and it's a part of treatment. And, of course, these goals are the client's goals. It's whether Bron thinks cooking the roast is the most important or getting those priorities. She might be glad for an excuse not to do it and prefer to do something else. And as we know, they're the ones that drive it the most, so it's got to be their goals, what they want to achieve. And therefore, all treaters GP, psychologist, physio, psychiatrist, we can all share the same goals and each be looking at how our own interventions can facilitate that achievement rather than each developing our own goals and probably overwhelming Bron. And therefore, the treatment plan, is, from a psychological perspective, is simply addressing the barriers to achieving those goals. Looking at the biopsychosocial, so even as a psychologist, it's making sure we're not just looking at the psycho, we need to be considering the whole person, looking at the function. And often I find it interesting when I supervise psychologists and train psychologists, they don't feel like return to work is their responsibility. But my question always is, who is it? Really, it's all of our responsibility to help facilitate that, whereas I think it's sometimes work can be the thing that the GP gets left with some degree because you might be doing the certificates of capacity, but really it's got to be the whole picture of all of us looking at what barriers may be going on for Bron and getting back to her work. And obviously then communication is needed. And this, is, I think, is one of the really big practical challenges. We have time. None of us are sitting around waiting for the phone to ring. We're all busy. But if that communication doesn't happen, it's too easy to head in different directions. And the research has a really strong evidence base with cognitive behaviour therapy and acceptance and commitment therapy in the area of chronic pain. So I'd be strongly recommending to ensure that the psychologist that you're referring your clients to works within these modalities and has that experience and confidence specifically in the area of pain. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Jackie. I would now like to ask Toby, our psychiatrist, to respond to Bron from a psychiatrist perspective.
Okay, I think firstly it's important that I say that I'm a pain psychiatrist, which is very different from a general psychiatrist, so the approach that I take is not what most general psychiatrists do. Because I have speciality training in both psychiatry and pain medicine, as well as addiction, I look at the whole picture, whereas most general psychiatrists will tend to focus on addressing the psychosocial and emotional consequences of the pain, and they rarely address the actual pain itself. On the other hand, most pain specialists, who are most commonly anaesthetists, tend to focus on controlling the pain. For the patient, this is a passive thing. For them, it's quite active. But they don't really address the emotional or affective components, whereas I look at both. From my perspective in this case, Bron's decompensated. She's not able to cope with the pain. She's not able to cope with the consequences. She has become totally demoralized and depressed. And in addition to this chronic pain disorder, she's therefore developed an adjustment disorder with anxiety and depressed mood. Her failure to adjust, as everyone's been saying, is really a result of a couple of things. Firstly, she doesn't really understand the nature of her pain. She still tends to believe that her pain is like acute pain, that it reflects continuing damage. She doesn't understand the nature of chronic pain, and because she's not been informed about this, she's reacting to it as if there's still ongoing damage and therefore still looking for a cure, something to fix the damage. The second thing she doesn't have is any effective strategies to deal with the pain when it arises or when it flares up, other than resorting to drugs or other people. That results in her becoming increasingly avoidant of activity. She then becomes more and more convinced of her inefficiency and loses self-esteem and loses heart. So that lack of effective strategies needs to be addressed by a couple of people, and it's one of the things we need to look at. The last thing is that we need to remember Bron's lost a lot of things. She has lost her ability to do several things which she took for granted before. And at this moment, she is so focused on dealing with the physical things that she has not addressed the emotional things, dealing with these losses, financial, personal, emotional, and that's left her feeling helpless, hopeless, and despairing. So that at the first perspective is purely from the psychiatrist's point of view. So from my point of view, I would be looking at doing a couple of things as a pain psychiatrist. My first thing to do is reduce an emotional distress, and I do that by providing her with information about the underlying pathology, things such as central sensitization of her pain pathways, helping her understand that the way her body is reacting is not because of imaginary pain or anything, nor, as all the doctors have pointed out, is there any active pathology, but this is a result of brain plasticity. Her brain has changed the way it deals with pain. in a sort of metaphor way, her car's tuning's gone out. She's not registering in the normal way. Second thing is facilitating her gaining understand the relation between her pain, in other words, the soreness, the physical sensation, and her emotions, how the pain makes her think and feel. The sense that when she gets up, the first thing she thinks about when she moves is it going to hurt? And tries to avoid that. And then lastly, in terms of her behaviors, how it affects her gait, her posture, things like cooking, because in a sense she's worrying that doing those things is going to make her pain worse. Now, in terms of dealing with emotional stress at this stage, when we see Bron at the end point, when I usually see her, she's already become quite depressed, and I might introduce an antidepressant, not only because of the mood, but because some antidepressants are really quite effective in chronic pain, specifically things like duloxetine, where they actually modify brain perception of pain. So they have a real use, as well as being antidepressants, on dealing with issues such as the emotional reaction to pain, the fight-flight response. Next, I'd be looking at reconditioning her responses. Now, this, the psychologists and the physiotherapists are very importantly co-workers in this. We need to look at providing her self-management strategies to control her pain, things such as trigger points, how to massage. We need to look at that. We need to change the way she thinks about her drugs, that she doesn't go for them first, but uses other strategies to become more independent rather than reliant on drugs. And then, very importantly in this case, we need to change the social environmental contingencies that enhance her sick role. In other words, Bill taking over all her formal domestic duties, having to give up work. It makes her feel more guilty. She is now dependent on him. She's not playing her role. He can't be out there earning. It's all her fault. So this is part of her depression as well. So we need to look at how we can change these contingencies. Now, the last thing I'd be looking at is facilitating her re-engagement in normal, meaningful activities. Encourage her to become an active participant in her own recovery. She's been a goer. She's been a doer. She's afraid to do anything. We need to get past that fear to get her to see that the more she does for herself, the better she will recover. In a sense, God helps those who help themselves. She really does have to help herself. And we get her to see that that's the best way to recover. We get her to engage in moderate exercise, again, together with the physio, psychologist, the occupational therapist, looking at what sort of activity is the most appropriate. And then looking at reinstating some of her other, her former social and other meaningful activities, things that made her feel good about herself. We need to get her to start joining in. She needs to become a valid person rather than an invalid person, an invalid. So what are my key messages? Well, firstly, anxiety, depression are very common in patients suffering chronic pain. It's in fact part of the pain response. Pain triggers a fight-flight response. Flight-fight response provokes anxiety, and when it runs for a long time, patients are running in a hyperadrenalized state. Chronic pain also aggravates pain. Aggravates anxiety and depression if it's pre-existing, and clearly it's aggravated by it. Lastly, in the treatment of patients with chronic pain disorder, we need to address not only the management of pain itself, but also the emotions and behavior that result from it. In other words, look at their changes in their patient's circumstances, to their mistaken, erroneous beliefs and expectations about the pain, understanding that it can't be cured, but it has to be managed. So, really, what we've got there is we need to work collaboratively. Physical treatment alone usually fails. Passive treatment usually fails. And psychotherapy, if given alone, usually fails. So the best way to manage chronic pain patients is in a multidisciplinary capacity. That's all I have to say.
Thank you very much, Toby. Now, I'm aware, I want to keep in mind that we probably have a number of rural and remote practitioners online who may be working in small towns where they don't have Empower Rehab on the corner. And so I just want to acknowledge that might be the case, and that we'll try and keep that in mind in our discussion. So sometimes the only person who is there is actually the GP. So I'd really be very interested to hear Stephen's response to meeting Bron. Thanks, Stephen.
Thanks, Mary. Well, I'm going to take you through a chronological response because I think it's really important to see how Bronn has evolved and how and our thinking of pain and slot that in. And at every point, the question that the GP should have in their mind is that how could we have done things any differently, or what could we have done then that would change the course of how Bronn developed. I think we have a lot about what we do with Bronn, how we deal with Bronn now that she's in the predicament that she's in. But she may not have to be in the predicament that she's in. If we had done other things, if we had done, why does somebody like Bronn go down one pathway? Why does another person go down a completely different pathway? And I have this little diagram of Descartes, and his view of pain was, as you can see, we've got fire and we've got a foot next to the fire and almost a cord that goes up the leg, up the back and into the brain. Now, just to make that connection, you know, that there's something, a connection between the foot, the spine and the brain, I think was quite advanced thinking in those days. Remember, this was done in about 14-something, which it makes it about 500 years old. So 500 years ago, people thought, well, Descartes at least thought about pain in this fashion. Does it differ that much to the way that we think about pain? I think we think about pain in very, very much the same way, that it is an inevitable consequence of injury. And again, what I like to do is get people to think about pain differently. So, we have Bronn, and the first thing we do is take a history of Bronn. And in the history, we look at our normal things, like the nature of the pain, the location of the pain, intensity, radiation, and exacerbating and relieving factors. I think we all do this in our general course of examination. In the first instance, Bronn doesn't present like anything strange. Like nobody, there's nothing different about Bronn. She looks like your normal average patient. So we do normal things. And part of what I want to introduce is examine Bronn, but we look for red flags. And the red flags are infection or signs of fracture or malignancy or nerve compromise in the case of Bronn. We talk about what investigations there are for back pain or whether any of these are appropriate for Bronn. If we do think that she has some red flags, then we really need to investigate them. If we think that she has a fracture, we need to do an X-ray. If we think that she's got nerve compromise, we need to do a CT or MRI, and so forth. But certainly these are the investigations for back pain. Then we look at treatment options with Bronn. The first few treatment options is, and the thing that goes through our mind is, okay, do I give her pain relief? What sort of pain relief do we give her? Do we need to rest her at all? How long do we rest her for? It's very important to look at the language we use straight first up when we talk to Bronn about how, what's the condition, what's the expectations, do we use physiotherapy, and when do we review Bronn? All of these things are quite important in the evolution of what is happening with Bronn. Next, if we see Bronn the next time, what do you expect from Bronn? Do you expect her to be better than she is? If she is not, why isn't she better? Are there any red flags that we missed? Does she need investigation now? If so, you know, what investigations does she need? These questions should be sort of popping up in the head. Why isn't she progressing? And what other factors they are? And we have these factors called yellow flags, which are the psychological risk factors for the development of chronic pain. And even at this stage, we should be thinking about what we do with them and whether she has any. Then, when you follow up, do we do an X-ray? Now, here the question is, if you do an X-ray and everything is normal, that's fine. What happens if you show up some disc degeneration, spondylolisthesis, facet joint degeneration? Do you think that this is the cause of a pain? You can be counterproductive in that, well, you know, there's something wrong with your back there and we need to fix it. Quite often there's not. Quite often we have incidental findings. And then there's a push of the patient to do something about it. And often, you know, we reach for the opioids then because it's a simple option. Well, you've got more pain, so then we up the pain treatments. So using an opioid is a simple option. You know, we still maybe fail to look at the red or yellow flags at this stage. And I certainly want to get everybody to use an opioid risk management tool. Now, they're all available on the web, and it's something that you can pick up and use whenever you start somebody on an opioid. Look at any risk factors first. Now, when we look later down the track, now we look 4 weeks later, again we should be asking ourselves, should she be progressing by now? Why isn't she progressing? Now, was there damage that was not detected previously? Do you investigate? Or, in our minds, is she malingering? Is there something going on there? What is happening? What is happening now? And we need to see the bigger picture of what's happening. We need to look at what's happening not only with the pain, but what's happening in her life. And, sorry, I think I've lost my webcam.
No, Stephen, we can still hear you.
Okay.
But
okay.
We did lose your camera. You had frozen for quite a while, and now you've disappeared altogether. So it's great that we can still hear you. Okay. If you've got your little box on the screen, you can click allow. But otherwise, just go ahead, because we can hear you.
Okay, not a problem. Something's happened. I hope I'm back on. I'll push on. So the options, you know, we have, do we send her to a specialist? Do we send her to a pain specialist? Do we send her to a psychologist? Do we increase her analgesia? Do we do more tests? And a big question is, if she's got psychological issues, how do we tackle these psychological issues, particularly for the country practitioners? What can you do about these things without referring to an expert? As you progress along, we've got 8 weeks. Her frustration, you get this sense of frustration, and this is having an impact on pain. Is the frustration actually making the pain worse? Would an MRI really help? Bill, his involvement, how significant is his involvement? You progress further. You look at the orthopedic opinion. Remember, the orthopedic opinion says, okay, nothing you can do. Is the orthopedic opinion right? So what do we do now? Do we give her the opioid? Now, she's clearly believing that pain is equal to damage. That is what we all brought up with. You've got pain, you've got damage, you've got more pain, you've got more damage. So is it destructive or unbelievable? And how do we tell her? How do we tell her that pain is not equivalent to damage? And what do you think about her recovery chances now? What do you foresee, you know, as outcomes for her at this stage? It is all looking fairly bleak. And certainly, if I was a GP at this stage, I'd be getting really worried about Bron. And then I'm still having problems with my webcam. I keep getting boxes. So finally, look at Bron and how she progressed. She started out as somebody quite average, somebody you would see every day in your practice. Then she ended up being one of these patients you hate to see. Oh, it's not Bron again with a pain. I don't know what to do about it. So I ask you, does this really happen in general practice? Well, it certainly happened to me. Now, the next question is that we haven't done anything particularly differently. So is this all inevitable? I mean, is that progression from acute pain to chronic pain beyond our control? Or can we actually do something about it? So certainly we need to ask ourselves this, and we need to look very closely at people like Bron, so that if we can intercept, if we can see the pain unfolding, then we can intervene. And it may be something really simple. Bron, you're okay, you can go back to work now. Yes, you still got pain, but that will go and you're fine and there's nothing wrong. Simple statements stop that progression to chronic pain, particularly right at the beginning. Sorry, I'm not on cam, but back to you, Mary.
Thanks very much, Stephen. I think that the tech support people will give you some instructions in the message box. So if you follow that, we'd probably be able to re-establish your video, but we can hear you. So thanks very much for that. And I do, this is unusual, but I have a quick weather update because there's been an emergency warning in Queensland. So if there's anyone in the Herbert or Lower Burdekin district, there are severe thunderstorms likely to produce damaging winds in the next several hours, which may affect Ingham and Rollingstone. So I don't know if we have anyone from Ingham and Rollingstone, but just for your information. Now, what I'd like to do is invite the panel participants to ask each other some questions. And a number of the questions that you have for each other actually reflect what the GPs are asking in the message box and also the questions that they submitted beforehand. So I think I'd like to first of all ask, we'll give Stephen a break. So Jackie, there was an interesting question. I suppose this is straight from the box. I'm going a bit out of order. But you mentioned acceptance and commitment therapy. Could you just give us a very quick overview of what that is?
So acceptance and commitment therapy is considered sort of the third wave of behavioralism. So it's the next development on from cognitive behaviour therapy. And what it involves is a real focus on psychological flexibility rather than rules and rigidity, which is often what is part of the problem in mental health issues. And the six core components are mindfulness, so being able to observe things like pain or mood or life without judgments and evaluations that often cause part of the problem. It involves diffusion, so creating space from thoughts rather than feeling like thoughts are therefore reality, and just being able to have that observing self, which is a third part of it. And then it also includes things like your values and committed action. So really what it does is it allows a decrease to stress from symptomatology of whatever nature, but also has that important focus on values and moving forward in action.
Thank you very much. Now, I know that that you had a question for Nick, which I think is quite relevant to our GPs as well. So that the question was about... what kind of interventions could physiotherapists and GPs be using to address psychosocial factors? So I guess I just asked that, but you were going to ask Nick that. So Nick, I guess, Jackie, I'm interested in why you asked that question. So clearly you think that there's some things that GPs could be doing and physiotherapists could be doing without just waiting for the patient to see a psychologist.
Definitely, because sometimes it may be that they don't need a psychologist intervention or you may not be able to find a suitable one. And really early on, it's more about addressing the psychosocial factors, and normally clients are seeing a GP and a physiotherapist. So to me, if they can address some of those psychosocial factors, it can hopefully avoid the complications that evolve.
So Nick, what kind of things do you do? Jackie was going to ask you.
Yeah, it's a good question. I think it's very easy to often expect only psychologists to address psychosocial factors, when in actual fact it's usually GPs and physios who are involved in the early stages who can have a great impact. And we know that there's really good evidence that good education that demedicalises a simple sprain or strain reassures the patient that, you know, that things will be okay, that this is what they can do to aid in their own recovery, to stay active and to get back into normal activities as soon as they can, not just based on pain but more so based on a time contingent, is a really important part of addressing psychosocial factors. Education, reassurance, explaining pain doesn't equal harm, and really assisting in assisting someone like Bron in re-engaging in those other social activities and work-based activities that are really important, valued activities, meaningful activities for Bron, are really an important part of I think what all GPs and physios can have a huge impact well and truly before someone like Bron ever sees a psychologist, and hopefully doesn't need to see a psychologist.
Thanks for that, Nick. Now there was, I think that you had a question for Toby about the role of the carer and Bronwyn's husband. which I think is something Toby's interested in.
Yeah, I found it fascinating just how Bron's husband had an intent to look after her, and you briefly mentioned that, Toby, in your presentation. I'd like you to elaborate on how you'd actually address Bron's husband's intent to look after her.
I think it's very important when you're dealing with families, particularly when you see that there's someone who's reinforcing sick role behaviours and, in a sense, colluding with the illness behaviour, to ensure that when you see when I see the patient for first time at least, I ensure that I see them together with their partner. It's as important for the person who lives with someone in pain to actually understand chronic pain as it is for them to understand it. If that person feels that pain still reflects damage, then effectively, if they care about that person, they will attempt and do everything in they can to prevent such damage occurring. Otherwise, they feel they're a bad partner. So one has to change the way they think to see that effectively, because this pain is not damage-related, but changes in the brain's neuroplasticity, that the best way they can help their partner is to encourage them to do things which are within their limitations, but although they produce pain, are not significantly likely to cause damage. So they can help by walking with the person rather than doing everything for them. So one has to address it pretty much head on. It's difficult in some families. The partner is often really quite overprotective, and often in compensation cases, there's an additional benefit in that the partner is being paid as a carer and may well prefer this to their usual day job because, in a sense, they can be doing a lot of it, but still have the excuse, well, it's not my usual job, so they don't have to do it as well as everyone. So I think the way that one has to address it is pretty much focus on how his efforts can either hinder her or can help her, depending on how he uses them, and making sure that he understands the concepts of chronic pain, about what sensitization is, and understands that this is all part of the brain's neuroplasticity. His partner's brain way of dealing with pain has changed, and it now overcompensates. It's like a speedometer that overreads. It reads 50 when you're going zero, but it also reads 100 when you're going 50. So being able to help them use concepts like that to understand what's going wrong with the pain mechanism and how they best help.
Thank you. And I think there's another the question about the complications when there's a compensation claim seems to be coming up a lot for the GPs. And I guess that is one of the problems about, you know, how do we negotiate all of that? Do we need to make a diagnosis early? Does that mean we need to do definitive tests early? It's quite a complicated question, and it's probably related, you know, different response to each case. But I know that you had a general question to Stephen about what are the kinds of problems in the general practice setting for managing somebody like Bron. And I suppose I have in mind our rural practitioners as well. So I guess I just asked Stephen that question on your behalf, Toby. Was there anything you wanted to add to that?
No, I think it's the difficulty is really trying to look at a GP in solo practice is having to be the psychologist, the psychiatrist, the physiotherapist and everyone else. So really trying to understand the complexity of this and, in a sense, trying to draw out of Stephen the importance of the general practitioner understanding what chronic pain is and how it's different from acute pain, and not to keep pushing the button of let's go look for a cure, but really looking more at let's try and see how we can deal with this pain.
Stephen, we're not able to get Stephen's camera back on, unfortunately, but I believe Stephen's still there on the audio.
Yes, I'm here.
So could you just respond to Toby's kind of question there and comment about the complexity of trying to deal with this on your own in general practice?
Certainly. I mean, the time constraints. I mean, most GPs, you know, have very limited time to deal with any patients, and our patient load tends to be huge. So looking at Bron, not having the time, I think, to deal with Bron is a difficult issue. And then the other thing would be access to services. You know, what services can you get? What sort of pain services can you get? Do we have access to physios? Do we have access to psychologists, et cetera?
Certainly, that also impacts on our ability to treat Bron. And then finally, after all of that, the GP quite often is left, you know, with having to deal with Bron at a particular setting and not having the ability or the knowledge to deal with her. So she just goes down, unfortunately, a fairly rocky path. And there's, because of the lack of resources or lack of knowledge of how to deal with Bron, I think it's all compounded. And sometimes we reach for the simplest solution, which is up the analgesia. Well, it's pain, so we up the analgesia, we use an opioid, we use a stronger opioid, and that gets her down a fairly rocky path.
Stephen, do you know if there's any web-based or telephone services that could be of support to Bron if she was living in a rural setting? And I guess by default that's also helpful for the GP. Or does any of the other panel members know of any useful websites or good information for patients that it's available online?
There are some that will help with chronic pain groups, but they're very variable. It depends very much on the participants. You'll get a lot of chronic pain self-management groups where the focus is whinging about what's not happening from anybody else fixing them, and why all the treatments never work for them, because they're not working, actually. Or you do get ones which are really very good at supporting their co-members with dealing with those losses. I would imagine one of the things that often can work positively for a rural GP is the fact that there's a community support for some people. It can work in both positive and negative ways, because quite frequently community stigma attached to the person not being at work can work to the exact opposite, or people who see that they're not being active is evidence of their being bludgers. So there are ways of using local community groups if they are positive, or internet-based groups if they're positive, but it's very difficult to advise patients which ones are going to work. That's what I've found. But then about you, Jackie?
Yeah, and there's also Chronic Pain Australia is a relatively new body that is trying to find ways to help consumers have access to support or information. And there's another body as well, I can't think of the name, I can picture their brochure. So there are a couple of larger bodies that are more web-based central that can provide links to things in different areas that would be worth looking at.
Another useful education resource can be the Pain Toolkit. I'm not sure if many have heard of that, but it came from the UK. But if so there's the UK-based version, but now there's an Australian-based version. And it's essentially it's just a whole range of really evidence-based self-management tips and strategies, such as pacing of your activities to assist people with persistent pain. Certainly it's not an answer to having good treatment, I guess, but it can certainly supplement and reinforce the sort of messages you might be getting from a good treater. So certainly if you Google Pain Toolkit or Australian Pain Toolkit, you can get some good tips off that as well.
Thanks.
There are books like Explain Pain, which are really quite useful and simplistic to give to the patient, let them read through it themselves and then come back and ask you. That's a way of providing psychoeducation with reducing the time, is to get the patient to do the work. It's meaningful, it's very useful, both practical as well, that they are actually having to look up about their condition. And then instead of spending time giving them information, you can help them form the framework and help them ask questions from what they've read. So it's another way of addressing it.
And we'll make sure that we get those websites and resources that you've just mentioned, as we'll put them on at the end of the slide presentation, so they'll be accessible to all participants on the website later on. I think there's an interesting question. You know, I've just noticed that it's a really good collaborative discussion we're having, but sometimes it's actually hard for GPs to know how best to work with other disciplines. So I guess, Jackie, you sort of had a question for Stephen along those lines. Would you like to go ahead and ask him that one?
Yeah, I suppose my question is, how do you recommend that we communicate with GPs in any discipline to facilitate that, because obviously as GPs you're very busy with short appointment times and things like that, to increase that interdisciplinary work?
Certainly. I think getting out to GPs and letting the average GP know what people do, what the other disciplines can do in terms of pain, I think is really important. The other thing is also, I mean, just increasing the knowledge and skills in chronic pain for the average GP. So you can see, if you can see something unfolding and you can't tackle it yourself, you know that there's somebody that can help you. I think knowing the roles are really important, and certainly knowing the what resources are available in that particular region, I think are also important. Certainly, I think in the city areas, the pain clinics are often very helpful, because a lot of them are open to a GP ringing up and saying, I've got a problem, what do I do? So I think look at your pain clinic or look at your local pain specialist, and they may be able to help you in that regard.
Stephen, one of the things I thought was also important for country GPs is the idea that often when they need to refer to a city, it's important that with work cover TAC type patients that they provide transport. Quite often they will not offer the patient transport, and the patient then is left trying to rebill to get their claim. So it's often worthwhile to actually write to them and say that you're referring to a city-based service because it's not available in the community.
Mm. And the patient sort of actually knowing that, that it is available to them.
Yes.
And I guess from a GP's point of view, perhaps Nick will go to you first as a physio. How can a GP work better with you? What kind of information is useful for you? How do you like to receive communication? Those kind of practical issues.
I think, the usual way is by letter, but I think it's so powerful to be able to communicate over the phone. We can communicate within 3 minutes what might take a page to write, and the other thing with that is it becomes much more collaborative. We can discuss what's going on, we can discuss the barriers, we can and very quickly brainstorm an approach. So I've certainly had good discussions with GPs where we've looked at a goal around a medication reduction, and the GP called me back saying, look, we're looking at maybe keeping that on hold. He's tried to do that in the past, but we focus on increasing his function first before we look at rationalising medication, and then we'll look at medication as a second plan. It would have been difficult to do that. There would have been four or five letters between us to come up with an agreement that would have been a better way to go, and to do that with the client in the room, so whether they're with me or whether they're with the GP, so that there's a bit of a three-way conversation would be even better, I think.
And can we assume that most physios understand chronic pain in the way that you do?
No.
Okay.
Unfortunately not. I mean, there's slowly a bit of a shift, and certainly more so within public settings. There's probably a better general understanding of chronic pain. Generally speaking, in the private practice community, the focus is still very much on symptom relief rather than focusing on increases in function, education, empowering an individual to take control over their own recovery. That really hasn't happened. So really trying to identify treaters who have more of that approach, that hands-off approach, to sort of engage with those treaters, I guess, is really important, because you can't assume that that all physios will be providing a good evidence-based approach to the management of chronic pain.
Now, one of the things that you mentioned was the Erebro score, and there's been some interest from the participants about, could you just tell us a little bit more about that, or at least where we can find out more about it?
So the Erebro score was developed probably about maybe 10 years ago in Sweden, and it's a 21-item questionnaire that essentially taps into yellow flag psychosocial risk factors such as anxiety, depression, poor coping with pain, the impact of pain on functioning and sleep, expectations of poor recovery, so expectations that the pain will be always there, or that the person might go back to work. And there are cutoffs for that Erebro score, and over 130 out of 210 predicts 86% of people with back pain who won't get back to work and will develop chronic pain and disability at 6 months post-injury when it's used at 4 weeks post-injury. So at 4 weeks, it can be a useful questionnaire to provide to clients to explain to them, look, this is a questionnaire I give to everyone at 4 weeks just to have a closer look at how things are going, look at you as a whole person, and we can use that as a tool to help stream people who would be considered at high risk to an early pain management approach that is, you know, involving the full team very early on. And certainly there's really good evidence that if you do that really early on, the outcomes are much better. So the one key thing with that is sometimes practitioners will screen who they provide that questionnaire to. And screening for a screening tool isn't a good way to go. There's really good evidence that we screen really poorly. We often assume people are doing okay when actually they're at high risk and vice versa. So using a screen for all those with musculoskeletal pain at 4 weeks, such as the Erebro, is a really simple but really effective tool to help identify just that high risk group, which is around about 20% of all musculoskeletal clients that we see.
Thank you, Nick. And Jackie, I noticed you're nodding your head there about the screening tool. And I also wondered if I can ask you the question about what GPs can do to collaborate well with a psychologist.
To me, one of the things that comes out of the screening tool, I find often even when it's used, no action's taken. It's like people want to wait and see until they're confident there's a problem, and particularly with referral to psychology, it's until there is an adjustment disorder, until it's actually developed to that point. Again, I'd agree with what Nick said of phone communication is so much more effective, and particularly doing it when the patient's in the room, it allows them to be part of it, unless it's something sensitive where you really want to be able to have a debate and discussion which may be unhelpful for a client. I think having them there, one, it's more time efficient, but the communication is actually a part of their treatment as well. It's not just something we do for fun. So having them there, letting them hear that transparency, I think can be really important, because sometimes these clients start to feel like everyone's talking about them, they might be withholding a particular treatment or some of these anxieties and concerns. So it ends up being effective between disciplines and treaters, but also with the client being there as well.
Thank you for that. We've actually had a very lively discussion for some time already, and we're up to the period of time where I'd like to invite the panellists to just sum up what a final key message. And I guess I'd like to welcome Stephen back on the video. We had you there on audio all the way, but it's good to see you back. So I'll ask you, first of all, if you'd just like to sum up any final messages.
I think a key message is that pain is a lot more complex than what we often think it is, and that we can have a major impact on the outcomes of somebody like Bron.
Thank you. I particularly noticed in your introduction that you said the things that we say, and I think sometimes as GPs we underestimate the power that a simple statement can have on somebody's interpretation of everything that happens afterwards. So I just wondered if you could expand on that just a tiny bit, or maybe even give us an example, because it's so powerful.
Certainly. I mean, when you look at somebody's x-ray and you say to them, well, oh, you have the back of an 80-year-old. what message are you bringing across to them? What are you saying to them? You need more rest. You rest and it will go away, or we need to find out the cause. I mean, you reinforce messages like, you need to find the cause of this pain. We need to look for it. You require more pain relief. You require more rest. Take it easy. Your husband's doing a really, really doing a great job looking after you. He's doing everything for you, isn't he? Again, statements like that we don't even think about sometimes, you know, it has an impact on the way that the pain progresses in the patient.
Thank you. I guess it is also complicated when we're trying to do reporting for work cover and return to work certificates. And I guess that's where the value of discussing those things in a team is really important. Jackie, did you want to just say something for a moment?
My key points are to see that psychosocial factors are relevant before there is a mental illness diagnosis, and that needs to be addressed. And following on from the language, I think it's even when we say not is can be just as much a problem. When you say you won't end up in a wheelchair, I don't think you'll need surgery, often clients don't hear the not, they hear the surgery, the wheelchair, and it's amazing what I hear that clients have heard from their GP, and then when I check with the GP, it's very different. So even being aware of the not. The other key thing, I think, is how you refer to a psychologist, because in Bron, the case study, it became very much, oh, you think it's all in your head. So really, I'd recommend referrals to psychology, and I'm getting it closely with psychiatry, is it's based on the problem that the client can see as going, okay, with, you know, you're not coping at the moment, or you're not sleeping well, or things are starting to get impacted. What we need to do is get people who can look at all the aspects of what's going on to get the best outcome for you. And I'd recommend as part of that, it would be an include a psychologist. I feel there's a lot of stigma and misunderstanding about the role of psychology. So the better that referral can happen, one, it makes our job easier, and therefore bringing it up earlier on makes it easier as well sometimes, to at least raise it so it's part of the language and the narrative that's already been talked about.
Thank you, Jackie. Toby?
I think there are five main points that I think are important for GPs managing chronic pain. I think the first is, and I suppose you've done this, is you confirm your diagnosis. Is this acute or chronic pain? It makes a huge difference. Secondly, one has to look at, is there any remedial pathology? Is there something that can be fixed? Because there's no point, because a patient's had pain for 10 months, to simply assume that that chronic pain doesn't have pathology. It's nearly as bad as looking that if it's been there and there isn't pathology, therefore it's psychogenic. One looks at things like that. One, it's really important to do a substance use history on all patients, as well as a past psychiatric history. We know that people who have suffered from affective disorders, anxiety, depression of any sort, tend to go on to become chronic pain patients much more commonly than others. I think it's also important that when you manage a chronic pain patient, you actually give them some hope. In telling a patient that chronic pain is incurable, it's important to point out things like diabetes also incurable, but they get managed, and if they manage well, the person can have full quality life. Similarly, it's important for them to understand that, like a diabetic, self-management is a lot better than someone else doing it. You can only be the person to live your life, and the more you do for yourself, the better it works. When it comes to treatment with drugs, it's important that you have a treatment agreement, that it looks at things like frequency of attendance, that they use a single pharmacy, that if they don't attend, they don't get a script, that there are no early refills, and that essentially if you believe that because of a past history of drug or other problems, that you do agree that they can have the random blood urine drug screen from time to time. And then probably most important, that if you're going to use opiates at all, use long-acting or slow-release forms of analgesics, things that are very long-acting, like methadone, are really very useful in chronic pain, although they're never pushed by the drug companies because there's no profit in it. They will rather sell you modified morphine or oxycodone. So there are other things to do, and it's important that they don't rely on the drugs. So those are seen as a crutch, and it's important to get that message through.
Thank you, Toby. And Nick, we've got 1 minute.
Look, I guess 2 points I'd like to make. One is, if we're looking at a biopsychosocial approach, then we should be looking at a biopsychosocial assessment. So right from day one, if I was seeing someone like Bron, I'd certainly be looking at the pathology, looking at the examination findings, the usual things that we would do, but also taking into account the psychological and social factors in the early stages. And again, something like a risk screening tool can help us with determining what relative components of someone's pain are attributed to each of those components of pain. And the other relevant point for physios is that there, I reckon, should be a fairly low tolerance to ongoing passive treatment. Mm. That if passive treatment isn't having a significant functional difference, a sustained functional difference after a few weeks, asking the question of the physio, how are we shifting towards a much more active approach that takes the hands off and empowers the individual to help themselves in their own recovery, not allowing that passive treatment to continue for months and months on end.
Thank you very much, Nick. Well, thanks everybody for a very meaty presentation, and I hope that we've managed to answer some of the questions from the participants as well. Thank you all panel members for your contribution. So I'd just like to thank all the participants as well for joining in our webinar tonight. I hope it's been useful for you. And as I said, you can follow up by looking at the slides on the website later. and you can watch the podcast or recommend it to other people. We'd love you to all be aware that the Mental Health Professionals Network operates Australia-wide, and there are often regular local meetings in your area, which are a great networking opportunity to meet the allied health professionals and find out their areas of expertise and interest. The next webinar will be on Working Together, Working Better, to support a young woman struggling with bulimia and depression. So it's a eating disorder and depression webinar. That's on Tuesday, the 4th of December. Please remember to complete the exit survey before you log out. So there'll be an exit survey tab at the bottom of your screen, and points will be uploaded and certificates of attendance for this webinar will come out in about 4 or 5 weeks. If you'd like to continue the interdisciplinary discussion, in fact, you're all GPs tonight, so if you'd like to continue a GP discussion, please feel free to stay on and use the chat box. And you will be sent the link to all the online resources associated with the webinar within 2 to 4 days. So thanks again, everybody, for your participation. And we look forward to seeing you again. I was just going to say here, if you would like to participate in a chronic pain and mental health MHPN network, that there is some interest in supporting the establishment and maintenance of chronic pain and mental health networks across the country. So you will receive a follow-up with the resources, an invitation to a survey where you can register your interest in that. And thank you again, and I hope you all have a very pleasant evening. Good night.
Good night.